This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Heidi Adams Fitzpatrick in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Family and friends sing and dance at the Bamenda residence of Emmanuel Banta, who Cameroonian separatists released from captivity on Saturday.
That's reporter Moki Edwin Kinzeker reporting on the release of a government official in Cameroon. Also, the office of Algeria's aging president says he'll resign before the end of the month. We'll look at some of the Somali army's challenges in fighting extremist group Al-Shabaab. And we're starting daily coverage of the 25th anniversary of Rwanda's genocide. That's on Sunday. We'll have these stories and more for you, so do stay with us. There is lots more ahead here on Africa News Tonight. In our top story at this hour, 2 weeks after Cyclone Idai slammed into Mozambique, some towns remain all but inaccessible because the storm washed away roads and bridges. That has slowed the delivery of desperately needed food and medicine, with most of the aid arriving by air. VOA's Mohamed Youssef visited the hard-hit town of Buzi, where he spoke with some of the survivors. And here are some of what they have to say. 42-year-old Sarah Chia was getting out for the first time since the cyclone hit her hometown of Buzi. She says she was not able to get help before because she was suffering from malaria when the flood came and could not leave her home. She is one of the lucky ones to receive help. It took aid agencies nearly a week to begin delivering supplies to Buzi. Most of the aid has come in by helicopter, although in recent days some supplies have come by road. Businessman Ayub Fakir Bai had 3 shops before the floods. He lost everything. He says he feels injured and disgraced. He has nothing left and says even getting food is a problem. While the town recovers from Cyclone Idai, its 150,000 residents expect to depend on humanitarian aid to survive for some months to come. Moving to North Africa now, and the Algerian president's office says longtime leader Abdelaziz Bouteflika will step down by the end of this month when his term is due to end. The ailing 82-year-old Bouteflika has faced mounting protests since announcing he would seek a 5th term in office. He then withdrew and delayed the election, and support by his ruling party and the military has been fading as the size of the protests increased, with an estimated 1 million people on the streets last Friday. Bouteflika's office says he will take important decisions to ensure continuity of the state's institutions before resigning. Bouteflika has been in office since 1999, but has been in a wheelchair and has been rarely seen in public since a stroke in 2013. The extremist group Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for a series of bombings and explosions in the Somali capital in the last 2 weeks that have killed at least 36 people. The attacks show the need for a viable Somali force to fight Al-Shabaab. But while commanders and experts say there are enough troops, they also say they're short on weapons and lack cohesion. Well, earlier I spoke to VOA reporter Harun Maruf about details obtained by Investigative Dossier. That's a VOA Somali program. I began by asking Maruf why the Somali forces are so under-equipped.
They are under-equipped because Somalia was under embargo for a long time. They do not have any new weapons. They do not have heavy weaponry. That is because the 1992 arms embargo imposed by the UN prevented Somalia from buying weapons. This embargo was eased in 2013, but still Somalia cannot buy anti-tank tanks, armored vehicles, and these troops are also short of operational equipment that you would need in order to defend against Al-Shabaab. But more importantly, Somali forces were trained by different countries for more than a decade, so they are not a cohesive, strong forces that have fought and battled together in many fronts. They are largely affected by the country that trained them, and they do not usually have the same command. The structure is very much weakened, and they are very much unresourced, and the chain of command is not always very strong because of external influences, including the country that trained, including clan influences.
You know, Aaron, these sound like such intractable problems. From all the reporting that you've done, what do you think is the most important thing that the government can do to deal with these problems?
Well, what the government can do is really to fight corruption, because Somalia is still allowed to buy small armies from other countries, and Somalia is it has really some resources. It has the longest coastline in Africa. It has a lot of ports. It's still getting a lot of resources. The ports are generating a lot of income in order to pay these soldiers. What the government can do is fight corruption. If you fight corruption, then the soldiers can be equipped and they can be paid. What the Somali soldier who's fighting with Al-Shabaab, against Al-Shabaab at the moment, is getting every month is $100. And they are not getting $100 every month. Maybe sometimes they don't get paid for 5 months. Sometimes they don't get paid for 4 months. So they're not getting their salaries regularly, and they're getting very, very small amount of money. So how can you expect that kind of soldier to defend the country, to defend a soldier, and to pay the ultimate price, his life?
Well, we've seen all throughout Africa in many places where the army is either not paid or underpaid, and we can all learn lessons from what happens when you do not compensate your military. You know, in Somalia also there seems to be this very divisive clan system where people pay allegiance to this system. Has this played a part in hampering efforts to build a sense of nationalism amongst the population?
It did, because for a long time the clan system has been more influential, have had more impact within the society in Somalia more than the national government. People trust their clan more than the government. Yeah. So this lack of trust has undermined the statehood and restoring a national agenda and nationhood, building nationhood before anything else. And this clan system is also undermining the chain of command. You have seen some of the probably 30% of the Somali military are not armed. If when they're going to go out to fight, they have to borrow weapons from clan. And halfway through the fighting, these clans can demand their weapons back. And some of the commanders might not have the ultimate loyalty for the state. They might have loyalty for individuals or clans. So this clan system is undermining building a very strong nation in Somalia.
There are so many issues that we even did not get to, and we hope to have you back to discuss some more of that. But thank you very much. There, VOA's Haroon Maarouf, thank you so much for joining us here in studio. Haroon Maarouf is from VOA's Somali service. Separatists in restive northwest Cameroon have, in a rare move, freed a former government minister unharmed after 2 weeks in captivity. Emmanuel Ngafeson Bantar, a top Ministry of Justice official, was the first advisor to President Paul Biya to be abducted in the northwest. Bantar says his stay with the separatists convinced him that an end to the three-year conflict with the separatists is possible if the government pursues sincere dialogue. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports. From Bamenda.
Family and friends sing and dance at the Bamenda residence of Emmanuel Bantar, who Cameroonian separatists released from captivity on Saturday. Bantar, a former Secretary of State in the Ministry of Justice in charge of prison administration, was abducted by armed men in mid-March. But while most Cameroon officials kidnapped by suspected separatists end up dead, Bantar says that his captors treated him well.
Would you imagine that they would come and tell me what is available and ask me what I would want to eat? Would you imagine that they supplied me with mineral water?
Bantar's treatment by separatists fighting for an independent English-speaking state in Cameroon is rare. Cameroon's government says at least 15 government officials and five traditional rulers have been abducted over the past 2 years. Nine were later found dead, while the whereabouts of eight others are unknown. Others were freed only after large ransoms were paid. Bantar would not say if he paid a ransom for his release. Human rights activist Frank Lindsay says Bantar's release may show that separatists are tiring of the fighting, which has killed at least 1,000 people in Cameroon, displaced 500,000, and brought economic life in rebel areas to a halt.
War cannot go without an end. We can't continue fighting when you don't know how the fight will end. We have lost many already. We've lost properties. I do believe it's a time for any rightful thinking son of the Northwest and Southwest to put up that thinking cap and reflections on peace.
Cameroon's Territorial Administration Minister Paul Atanganji says if the rebels are serious about peace, they should drop their guns and be pardoned, as President Paul Biya asked.
Some of the terrorists in certain localities have willfully handed over their weapons to the forces of law and order. They were realistic because they know that you cannot fight a state. We have pockets of resistance, but how long will they last?
Cameroon's separatists complain the country's English speakers are treated as second-class citizens in the Francophone Central African country and want to create an independent state. The international community has condemned violence from both the rebels and security forces and called for a negotiated end to the conflict. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Bamenda, Cameroon.
As the 25th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide approaches on Sunday, we bring you a series of deeply moving profiles of men, women and children who survived the ordeal in 1994. Now they are talking about the lives lost, the new lives they have built and their hopes for their country. Today in the Survivors series, we hear from Lydia, a 46-year-old farmer who was left single and childless. Lydia lost 73 family members during the genocide. Her husband, children and other family members were thrown into Chihuahua Lake between Kigina and Nyarubuye. Lydia lives on 30,000 Rwandan francs per month provided for by the Genocide Survivors Assistance Fund. She was raped repeatedly by several men on the very spot where her husband was killed. Lydia now has to hire people to till her land because she's unable to lift a hoe. She says her only hope is that she will live long and die of natural causes.
I lost all my children, my husband, my parents, the parents of my husband, and all their families. Long ago, when someone lost a husband, her family or other people would help her. But for us, it was different. You would think you're the only one in that situation, but later you realize that there are others like you. One thing that hurt me most was to lose my siblings, my children, and my husband. I was with my children when they died. There's a lake between Kigina and Nyarubuye. That is where the mob took us. When we reached there, the Interahamwe gave orders to let the women leave. I had three male children and my sister's son. They were tired of using machetes, so they threw my children into the lake. After they threw them into the lake, I threw the baby carrier I had in the water too. They pulled it back using the upper limb of a bull. They beat me seriously. We're letting you leave, but you must bear us children. You should not bury the baby carrier. We have killed Tutsis, but you will give birth to Hutus, and you'll carry them on your back, they told me. After they had killed my children, they took me to the leader of the Interahamwe. He raped me in public. They took turns to rape me, one after the other. It is a deep thing. I can never forget. After the genocide, our houses had been destroyed. People had been killed. We lived in camps until we went to live in some other people's houses that had not been destroyed. The government of national unity later built for us some houses, but the houses were not strong enough. However, they have now repaired them. We now have good houses. Life continued. They gave us emergency aid. Life is now better compared to what it was before. We have some cows, and we hope the future will be better. During the trainings we had, we realized that not forgiving would be another heavy burden or even cause several incurable diseases. That is a step that we took after the training we had. We were able to forgive people that asked for forgiveness and those who did not. I have forgiven them. I even did not take them to the Gachacha courts. I forgave them. I think reconciliation is necessary because a country without reconciliation is a divided country. We would be heading nowhere. I think even those who have not yet forgiven should go ahead and forgive to enable reconciliation to take place, because if you have a grudge at heart, you can never live well with your neighbors.
And that was Lydia, a survivor of Rwanda's genocide. Well, as that country prepares for the 25th anniversary of the genocide, its people are reflecting on the violence perpetrated against the Tutsi. Some of those convicted of playing roles in the wave of deadly violence are serving prison sentences. They say they've confessed and embraced reconciliation. Some of those who will soon be released have vowed to not promote ethnic discrimination again. Then there are those who claim they are being illegally imprisoned after finishing 25-year sentences. Over a million ethnic Tutsi and moderate Hutus were killed during the genocide. Eugene Uwimana visited Mgeregere prison and brings us this story.
Mudadari Pierre Celestin is the chief of prisoners in Kigali's Mageragere prison. He's among 1,863 genocide convicts who are serving time there. He's talking during a visit by the Ministry of Justice and other players in Rwanda's justice sector. He spoke of fellow prisoners who he claims are being denied justice. There are many who have been denied their rights of appealing. There are also some who have been jailed by incompetent courts. Fixed assets of some prisoners have been auctioned without any court decision. Honorable Minister, we beg you to help us get our dossiers from the National Commission for the Fight Against Genocide, because some prisoners claim that they are still in jail when their sentences have ended. He specifically mentioned Emmanuel Wimana, who was jailed for 18 years by a traditional court only to have the correctional service decided 30 years. It denied to release me, saying that there are other fires in the Commission for the Fight Against the Genocide, which is, say, 30 years. Justice Minister and Attorney General Johnson Businye says his group will examine such claims. With these sectors, we are together here, Rwanda Investigation Bureau, prosecution, all who are here, I promise that they will give you the responses. And if you feel satisfied, well, if not, it will be due to different reasons that we will study again. Some genocide prisoners have shown remorse and apologized to the families of victims. Mwamini Nyirandegeya has served 20 years of her life sentence and knows she will not be released. Please go and tell Rwandans that we the genocide perpetrators have been already corrected. We have recognized atrocities we have committed. Tell Rwandans that we are sorry and urge them to be united. Mwamini urges the government and other civil society organizations to work hand in hand to rehabilitate ex-prisoners. She says it is not easy to face and live with families whose relatives were killed or who escaped death. This is what Prison Fellowship Rwanda does. The faith-based non-profit organization works with the government to foster reconciliation, peace and social healing for individuals affected by the 1994 genocide. Jean-Paul Ntwari is the organization's chief operations. He explains how and why they have taken the initiative. We accompany genocide prisoners in their lives. Several studies have shown that trauma and depression in prisoners have climbed higher. Prison Fellowship approaches them. We have our psychologists. They have them in several sessions with their families, the families of victims, and they found economic projects so that they run them together as partners, as the way to properly integrate and mobilize the world community. Come back from the prison where relatives of victims who say they have healed. Skugawa Samori's father was killed in the hospital. He says unity and reconciliation activities seem to have produced sweet fruits. Now Rwandans are marrying each other regardless of their differences. We are equally collaborating, whether you are Tutsi, Hutu or Twa Rwandan. And the good thing is that even the genocide prisoners who come back from jail have good behavior. I think trainings and other correctional services they undergo really work. However, there are other Rwandans who aren't ready to forgive and disseminate discriminatory messages that could revive the genocide ideology. Rwanda Correctional Service now counts over 27,000 genocide convicts, and it says only about 6,000, or 22%, have apologized and been forgiven by victims. The government says the anniversary will draw many international figures. It even invited French President Emmanuel Macron, who leads the country that Rwanda accuses of playing a major role in the genocide. Eugene Wimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Heidi Adams-Fitzpatrick in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, do visit our website at voaafrica.com. And please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports that's coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thank you for choosing the Voice of America.
This is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On April 7th, the United Nations marks the 25th anniversary of the genocide in Rwanda. More than 800,000 people, mostly Tutsi, were killed. An in-depth discussion of what Rwanda and the world has learned from this tragedy on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5-minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the Sunny Side of Sports, Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.